Well, you rarely see early depictions of women and women's life in rural Australia, especially women who've had a significant contribution to the country. We all know about John MacArthur. He's credited with establishing the wool industry in Australia, but possibly more of the story is actually Elizabeth MacArthur, his wife, and I'm not sure if she gets perhaps the credit that she deserves. So we thought we'd address this morning on the program, find out a little bit more about this amazing woman. And we're joined by Michelle Scott-Tucker, who is the author of a biography on Elizabeth MacArthur, A Life at the Edge of the World, a fascinating biography indeed it is. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. On reading a little bit about this woman, there's no question she's an incredibly remarkable person.
She really is, and yet she's not a household name, which is pretty disappointing.
It is a very disappointing thing. I mean, you know, as I mentioned before, John MacArthur on the $2 note there, I reckon he might not have even been there if it wasn't for her.
Well, I think that's entirely possible. He got the kudos, but it was Elizabeth who shipped the first commercial quantities of wool to London because he wasn't even in the country.
We'll just go through some of her things. I mean, she had remarkable people skills and diplomacy skills because she was dealing with the upper echelons of society and of government, incredible organisational skills. She had the acute business acumen because she was able to develop this business, a very profitable business, from nothing. Incredible work ethic and dedication because she did a lot of the work herself. She rode out on the farm by herself. She obviously dedicated 9 kids. And her practical application, yet in amongst it all, she was quite a charming woman. She was an attractive woman and a humorous woman as well, and a very composed person.
She seems like a bit of a paragon, doesn't she? But she was just a normal, ordinary, country English woman, quite popular, very ambitious for her family, and wanting what was best for them and prepared to work hard to get it.
It should be said that I've read somewhere that she was the first cultured woman to start living in Australia, to come to Australia to live. It's probably a little bit unfair, but she certainly brought a bit of society, didn't she, to Australia, to Sydney in that time?
She did. She arrived on the Second Fleet. So she arrived in Sydney Cove in 1790, and at that time there were convicts, female convicts there. There were some convicts, some male convicts' wives. There was the reverend's wife, but she was the only genteel woman in the colony and the only woman with any sort of education. And as a result, she was instantly and remarkably popular. All the officers loved to visit with Mrs. MacArthur, and they'd bring her little gifts, and they gave her a piano, and they'd have little recitals, and it was all seemingly very jolly, even though the colony at that stage was pretty dire, actually.
And, you know, coming after that, her husband certainly got involved in his fair share of controversies, and we'll get into that a little bit. But I suppose we should go back to the start first and talk about she was born in England and she was very well educated, and that's probably one of the strengths that you see theme throughout her life, not just hers but her children. A lot of emphasis on the importance of education.
Look, education was very important to her, and her own education was probably pretty informal. If you've read any Jane Austen or if you've seen any of those wonderful ABC Bonnet dramas, you're familiar with the sort of village she was brought up in. It was a remote village in southwest England, on the border of Devon and Cornwall, about 50 families, and she was a farmer's daughter. Nothing particularly genteel or special about her, but her best friend was the daughter of the local reverend, and she spent a lot of time at her best friend's house. And she was probably educated by the reverend or the reverend's wife when she had time. And as a result, she was an articulate, well-read and could write very well also.
So she's bumped into this bloke, MacArthur.
Again, that was part of a Jane Austen story. The farmer's daughter fell in love with a handsome soldier.
Right.
And the village did not approve. They thought John was a bit too haughty and proud for a man with no fortune and no particular future. But it was a love match, and the two fell in love. And we know it was a love match because 5 months after the wedding, Elizabeth gave birth to a bonny baby boy. And with that boy, the two departed for New South Wales.
Very polite way of putting it, a love match.
That's right.
Okay. Do you think that timing had anything to do with them moving to the colonies?
Look, I really think it did. Historians have said, oh, no one would have batted an eye at a baby born 5 months after the wedding at that time. But I've done some research and I don't think that's right at all. I think Elizabeth fled the village. She didn't have the baby in the village. She had it en route to London and had the baby in a pub by the side of the road near Bath, all by herself, the poor thing.
Where was John?
Oh, one wonders, doesn't one?
He's probably in the pub.
Yeah, one maybe. And she never took that baby back to live in the village. And I think she left for England because what was the alternative? If John was going to New South Wales anyway, she didn't want to go back to the village with that baby that was big for dates and have them pointing their fingers and saying, we told you so. And so she set off for New South Wales with her husband, the only officer's wife at that time to do so. And she might as well have been going to Mars, really. It was the other side of the world.
I mean, I wonder if that the strength of feeling was so strong there that because she never did go back to England, did she?
She didn't. She talked about it and sort of wistfully thought it would be nice to go back to England, but circumstance always intervened. And so for the rest of her long life, she stayed in New South Wales.
So anyway, so she's met Hot John. As you say, it was a love match. They've jumped. He's signed up to come out to be a soldier in New South Wales. She's jumped on the ship with him, with their child, because I just mentioned they've already had a boy. She was pregnant again.
She was.
And on the way out here, she had a bit of an upsetting thing
Her. Well, it was a terrible voyage. It was one of the worst convict voyages in the history of transportation. She's pregnant. If you've ever been on a boat, you'd probably know she's probably seasick as well. She's in cramped quarters. When they touched in at Cape Town, John fell ill and he was at death's door as they headed across the Southern Ocean. They didn't have a good voyage across the Southern Ocean. There was heaps of storms. It was really rough. They're travelling in the really high latitudes to get around the bottom of Tasmania. So it was an awful, awful voyage. She's got this little boy who's only about one and he's quite unwell. As well, her husband's unwell. She's pregnant and she's rolled and pitched with the boat and she goes into premature labour somewhere on the Southern Ocean. She gives birth to a little girl who lived only for 1 hour and is buried somewhere out there. So it was a few weeks later that the ship's limped into Sydney Cove and she can only have wondered what the hell she was doing.
It's just the mind boggles, really, to think about how sad she must have been. Yeah, as you said, might as well have been going to Mars as she's landing on the other side of the world. I wonder if that trip and the toll it must have taken on her emotionally, maybe that affected that she never went back to England because she's scared of the return passage, perhaps.
Look, I wonder about that. She never says so, and she always says she's willing to go, but she, for the rest of her life, she always finds excuses not to go. And who would blame her not to want to set foot on a ship again, given that it had been so awful? Yeah. She had the opportunity, and it never really came about. So it was a bittersweet opportunity for her.
That certainly didn't put her off having more children, you'd have to say, because she had nine in all. That's
Nine in total. It is an excellent effort. And sometimes I think of Elizabeth Castle like Ginger Rogers, doing everything that Fred Astaire did, except backwards in high heels. So with nine kids, it adds an extra degree of difficulty, that's for sure.
A more remarkable story, even, isn't it, that she was able to do what she did with that sort of... she obviously had a fair bit of help to raise the children. But again, with the kids, this education thing, she's really big on educating the kids and making sure that they knew what they were doing.
It's really important to them. And so she ends up having four sons who survive. And it's always the sons who get the education rather than the daughters, which was typical of the time. We're talking the early 1800s here. And the sons all got sent back to England to go to school. So as soon as those little boys turned 8 or 9, she put them on a ship. Occasionally one got sent off by himself on a ship back to England. And one of those little boys, the second oldest, she sent off. He was 7 when he got on the ship. She never saw him again. He went to England, he became a lawyer, he grew into a fine adult, but he never came back to New South Wales, and she never saw that little boy again. It's just heartbreaking in all sorts of ways.
I'm sure it would have been for her very much. Speaking of education, I've got a text here that from Woz that says, my children went to the Elizabeth MacArthur High School in Narellan in New South Wales.
Isn't that fantastic? So in around the area where her family farmed, there's quite a few memorials to Elizabeth MacArthur, including that wonderful high school. There's a copy of the book in the library, just you can let your kids know. And basically everything down there is called MacArthur or Elizabeth MacArthur. It's good.
And there is, of course, Elizabeth Farm, a very famous historic property that she was
That's
part
right.
of.
Which is out at Parramatta, which is a wonderful living museum. People can visit it daily, but it's not set up to be, please don't touch this. It's set up with replica furniture. You can lie on the bed, you can lounge on the couch, you can sweep the kitchen, and it's a terrific experience to get in there and see how Elizabeth really lived on a day-to-day basis.
I'm guessing she would have liked the fact that it isn't too stuck up and stingy and you're allowed to interact with the stuff in the house.
Look, I think she would have. She's often been painted in the past as some sort of social climber or a bit of a snob, and I didn't find any evidence of that at all. She's a Devonshire lass, so as soon as she opened her mouth, you would have known that she wasn't posh. They all speak like pirates down there. and she didn't yearn for the fancy house or the fancy trappings. What she wanted was security for her family, and that's what she worked hard to do.
One of the things, remarkable things about her, it's at a time when people were pretty keen to hook the boots in and get stuck into the privileged society and to all sorts of, you know, they didn't hold back when they were making comments on the other person. She is someone who's apparently it's very difficult to find a negative word said about her.
It is, and I think that's partly because her husband was so difficult and awful that a lot of people just felt sorry for her. but she was very highly regarded. She had lots of friends amongst the genteel community out there, like an expat community, really, that people go in to do a job for a couple of years and then leave again. So it was difficult for her to make firm friends because her women friends were coming and going all the time. She had lots of male friends as well. She was friends with everyone who was anyone. So Governor Phillip, Australia's first governor, Matthew Flinders was a friend of hers. The Macquaries, Lachlan and Elizabeth Macquarie, were good friends of hers. In 1836, Charles Darwin visited Sydney, and of course he had lunch with the MacArthurs, as one does. So she was really a player in the Australian society as well as cementing her own family's future.
And that community of CISO workers, we let it call them sail in, sail out workers.
That's right.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about John there. He perhaps wasn't the most pleasant person to be married to. He had his own raft of problems and issues. And in many ways, she smoothed over a lot of that for him, perhaps. But he certainly came to a bit of disgrace in the country, didn't he?
He did. He was forever picking quarrels. He was a really difficult man to work with. And this is a community of, in the early days, of only a couple of thousand people. So you sort of had to mind your P's and Q's in order to get along with everyone because there was no getting away from them. And John didn't bother doing any of that. He was always happy to pick a fight, always happy to fight a duel. The whole pistols at dawn, 20 paces thing, it's unbelievable.
Did he do that very often?
He did that at least three times that we know about. It's just...
Do we know the outcomes of those duels?
We do. Two of them ended in no result, but one of them he managed to shoot his commanding officer in the shoulder, which is never a career-enhancing move.
And, oops.
And in fact, he and the commanding officer got sent back to England to be court-martialed. Huh. And that was the first time that Elizabeth had to look after the properties. At that stage, they only had two and a couple of thousand acres. She had to look after the properties on her own while John was away for that period for nearly 5 years.
And was he court-martialed? What was the outcome in England?
Oh, no, he talked his way out of it because he could talk the leg off a brown dog. So he got out of it and, in fact, came home covered in glory with half a dozen of merinos from the King's very own flocks at Kew and with an important letter that gave him access to a land grant of 5,000 acres of the best land in the colony.
Very handy.
Very handy.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, the governor of the day was less than impressed when he came back with that.
A letter from the king.
Yeah.
Sorry, mate, I've gone over your head.
And so he selected that land down at Camden, which is southwest of Sydney, and it's called Camden because it was Lord Camden who gave MacArthur that particular grant.
Okay.
And so John should have spent the next couple of years establishing a property down there, putting up the infrastructure and getting all that ready, not least because by then they had seven kids surviving, and the youngest kid was only eight. So there's a lot of work to do at home. Their eldest daughter fell ill during this period with something probably like polio. It involved paralysis. But instead of helping out at home, John overthrew the government and was involved in the Rum Rebellion against Governor Bligh.
We'll come back to that in a sec. I just want to get back to the merinos that he brought out, the King's merinos.
The sheep.
Are they they're the merinos that they started the business with, or did they already have a couple of merino sheep?
They already had some sheep, and they were beginning to breed for fine wool. They'd brought some so-called Spanish sheep over from Cape Town that were probably crossbred merinos, nothing like the big merino you think of today with the big folds of skin under his chin and the curly horns. But they were starting to breed for fine wool because they could afford to. The common farmers had to sell their sheep for meat because then you get cash instantly, whereas breeding for wool is the long game. And the MacArthurs could afford to diversify. So they also bred horses, they bred cattle, they had shipping ventures going, they had commercial ventures going in town. They were like the clever, shrewd business people that they were doing multiple business activities in order to see which one would be the most profitable, and it turned out to be fine wool.
Now, those merinos, are they the first sheep that our entire merino industry was based around?
The ones that John brought over weren't the first ones. The first ones came over from Cape Town. So a few people were breeding sheep at this stage, and the MacArthurs were one of a group that were breeding for sheep. But the MacArthurs were the only ones that had the secret weapon of Elizabeth at home. As I said, she was a farmer's daughter, so she already had some skills to go with it. And with John in England at various times, he could act as an agent for the family. So when they eventually did get enough wool to send over to London to sell, they had someone there on the ground in London to help market the wool to the purchasers over there, which really helped them out.
I would imagine communicating would have been quite difficult there, communicating by letter, but it was pretty handy. Now, we'll come back to John and the Rum Rebellion, because, the Rum Rebellion is synonymous in Australian history with corruption. What was his role in that?
Oh, his fingerprints were all over it, and he pretty much drove it from behind the scenes. The ostensible leader of the rebellion was the man that was then in charge of the army, Major Johnston. But historians agree that MacArthur was all over it. He was pushing from behind to make this happen. He'd fallen out pretty seriously with Governor Bligh beforehand. And as soon as Bligh was under house arrest and the coup was done, John pretty much took over running the whole colony for the next few months. And Elizabeth supported him publicly, but very quickly moved back out of Sydney and back to Parramatta and left him to it, because I think she'd realised that the only person she could rely on at that stage was her, and that John just wasn't going to be there for her.
Because he was distracted by what was going on in Sydney, or just because of general not being that interested?
I think because he was distracted by what was going on in Sydney, once he got an idea in his head, he followed it kind of manically, really, and he'd have these wonderful genius highs of activity where, you know, he could take on the world, and they'd be followed by some crashing lows and crashing depression where, you know, he couldn't drag himself out of bed, the poor man. And so she probably had a bit enough of dealing with that and knew she had the kids and the family to look after. The thing that the history books also often won't tell you about the Rum Rebellion and John's role in it is that, as I said, he had these things going on at home. He should have been working on the farm and looking after his unwell daughter. Elizabeth, at that stage, was 42 years old, and she'd fallen pregnant again. There'd been an eight-year gap with her last baby, so she might have thought she was done with those sorts of things. But she was well pregnant again during the Rum Rebellion, and John's basically put his head in the noose by committing a treasonous offence. And if the head of the family goes, then her whole family's going to fall. So it's a shame I wasn't a fly on the wall for that particular conversation.
I'm sure it would have been very interesting.
After the rebellion.
So what were the repercussions for John from England?
He got sent back to England to face to face the music. It wasn't for a year or so that he ended up going back to England, but he did have to go back to England to face the music. He wasn't put up for trial for various complex technical reasons, but he wasn't able to return home because he would face arrest if he did return home. So he ended up having to stay in England for another 7 or 8 years. And again, it was Elizabeth who held the fort at home and did all the work while he wrote her letters from England complaining about the quality of the wool and how sad he was.
What a bloke.
His choice.
He sounds like he spent more time in England than he did in Australia.
He spent a total of over 12 years in England.
Goodness me.
And yet he gets all the credit.
Unbelievable. I've got a text here from BMO that says she was married to a lunatic. That's a polite way of putting what BMO said here. And in many ways, she was. You mentioned a little bit about his mania before. When he did eventually get back to Australia, there was certainly a mental illness lingering in the background.
Look, there really was. By the time he came back to Australia, it was 1817. By the time he got back, the farm, he picked up the farm and carried on with it. And the 1820s were a boom time for the MacArthurs and for the colony in general. They did extraordinarily well. And you'd think Elizabeth could relax by then, but John was definitely exhibiting mental illness at that stage. He became a serial litigant. He was just not quite right. And in fact, by the end of the 1820s, he was declared legally insane, to use the terminology of the time. And he was confined at home at Parramatta. His sons would look after him. He wouldn't have anything to do with any of the women in the family. That apparently just set him off, and he was quite violent. So they confined him at first at Parramatta and then down at Camden Park. And for the last 2 years of their marriage, they were in their 60s by this stage, Elizabeth didn't see John, couldn't see John because it would just set him off again. And he died down there at Camden in his 60s, not quite right. And Elizabeth writes about it in a really modern way, actually. She understands that it's the illness and not the man. And it's quite prescient the way she writes about that mental illness, even though she can't really discuss what it is. And I've spoken about it with some psychiatrists who say very careful things like, oh, I can't possibly diagnose someone over 200 years. And then you explain what he was like and they go, oh, you're definitely bipolar, no doubt about it.
I shouldn't laugh. But I mean, there are elements of paranoia, and he had a fear that Elizabeth was having an affair, didn't he?
Yeah, and that is just his paranoia coming out. If I'd found evidence of that, I would have written about it, but there was nothing. He also thought his sons were poisoning him. He had a whole lot of conspiracy theories going on at the end, and that is just the illness speaking rather than any accurate positions on his part.
Just it's a mark of the woman that she was able to see that in many ways.
It really is, and of her ongoing love for him. It really was a love match. He was a difficult man to be married to, but throughout his marriage he wrote in these complaining letters he wrote to Elizabeth, they were always loving letters as well, and he was deeply grateful to her for the work that she did, always very loving to his family. They thought the world of him. It was just the outside world that couldn't get on with him quite so well.
Now, she outlived him by 16 years, as you said, or thereabouts. What did she do in the 16 years that she had by herself?
Well, you'd like to think that she retired quietly, but it didn't quite work out that way. She had some grandchildren. Her daughter's married and she had some grandchildren to enjoy. But in the way of these big farm families, the sons started fighting over their father's will. And that drove her mad, actually, because for her it was all about the family pulling together and working together. And for a long time the boys didn't tell her that they were arguing about the terms of the will. And when she found out, she basically went ballistic in a letter to one of the sons in England and gave him a serve and set out quite clearly how important family was to her and how she couldn't believe that they were all working together and how they'd all worked really hard to get to this point and you should basically pull his head in and move forward. And she had holidays in Watson's Bay. They had a house in Watson's Bay on the harbour, and as an old lady she'd go up there for her holidays. And in fact, that's where she ended up passing away. She was in her 80s by that stage and died in a good death, if you can call it that, surrounded by her family, successful, financially successful, and her family doing really well. She couldn't have wished for more, really.
It's a remarkable story, isn't it, Elizabeth MacArthur? Look, if you'd like to say anything, you've got any thoughts on this one, give us a ring. 1300 800 222 is the number to call. 1300 800 222. You might know a little bit about it. You might have visited Elizabeth Farm or any of the properties. You might have read a little bit about Elizabeth MacArthur. I'd love to hear from you. 1300 800 222. The text number is 0437 774 774.
The ABC, celebrating the UN Year of Indigenous Languages.
My name is Phyllis Yankapota. I'm from the Wik Nation in Arakoon. I'm from the Uplitch Clan Group. Did you know Taipan is a word from Arakoon in the Wik Munkan language? And you're listening to ABC Radio.
Find more place name stories at abc.net.au/thisplace.
This morning we're joined by Michelle Scott-Tucker, who is the author of a biography about Elizabeth MacArthur, A Life on the Edge of the World, which is a fascinating biography about basically the woman who established the Australian wool industry and someone perhaps we don't give enough credit to. You mentioned before, Michelle, about the fact that the sons were fighting over the wool. One of the ironies, I suppose, to that is in the end there were actually not many people to take on the family fortune, wasn't there? Weren't in the end many heirs or many descendants that could actually...
That's right. It was given that she had so many children, 9 in total, 4 sons who survived, but most of the sons didn't marry, and the one that did only had 1 daughter. And so eventually, through various means, all the properties and all the money devolved on that one granddaughter. And she, like her grandmother, was a shrewd businesswoman and an excellent farmer. She had 8 children of her own. She became widowed in her 40s, and she was a fantastic farmer who re-established the farm into dairying, as it happened, won prizes for her farming skills, and again was renowned just like her grandmother. So there's clearly a thing with women farmers in that family. They do quite well.
What was her name?
Her name was Elizabeth.
the name that she married into?
Elizabeth Onslow. So she married a man called Onslow, and the family name became by deed Paul MacArthur Onslow to maintain that MacArthur link. And the MacArthur Onslows were, again, quite well known throughout the colony.
Descendants now? There must be a few of them.
Squillions. Yeah. Squillions of them. And, in fact, her direct descendants still live in the family home down at Camden. But they open it up once a year for an open day, which is excellent. It's in September and I can recommend it. But the family lives down there. It's still a working farm on nearly 1,000 acres. And at the local Department of Agriculture nearby has a flock of the original MacArthur sheep that they've sort of kept pure via inbreeding, which is an interesting little flock as well. Again, they don't look quite like the big merinos of today. They're quite small, nondescript little sheep, but they're historically very interesting.
And an extra toe or two, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right.
I got interesting here. I'll just ask you a broad question, though, because, I mean, she gives us a remarkable insight into rural life and the life of rural women at the time. And it is a remarkable insight at that. But why do you think in Australian history so few of these women are recognised for their deeds?
I think there's lots of reasons why, and I think it's naive to think that history doesn't change and that it's kind of carved in stone. The stories we tell ourselves reflect the people we are today. So when I was at school, we didn't learn anything about Aboriginal people or Indigenous culture, and now that's changed, and kids definitely do, and so they should. And when I was at school again, if you're going to learn about history, it went Captain Cook, First Fleet, Gold Rush, and you sort of skipped that whole historic period. But people are more and more interested in some of the other stories now and looking at, I guess, the reverse of the embroidery. And perhaps we're a bit sick of hearing stories about white men at work. Burke and Wills, there's a story that didn't end well, or Ned Kelly, that story really didn't end well. But he's an interesting, intelligent, successful woman, and she's not a household name, and she probably should be. And I think people want to hear stories now and hear histories that reflect their own stories. And in leaving out half the population, in leaving out the history of women, and in this case, the history of Australian women farmers, of whom there are lots, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice.
Most certainly. I mean, it's often been remarked and remarkable to me and Trevor, Trevor who regularly does this, normally does this program, how many, with this segment, how many women that we had no idea about that have turned up and you think, well, how come I don't know about that person? And the list is quite long. It's, you know, everyone from suffragettes to, as you say, rural people working on farmers to people like Helena Rubinstein who developed cosmetics industries. It really is an enormous list of people, and at least we're doing a little bit to address it this morning.
That's
on the
great
program, which is a good thing, isn't it? All right, and I was just wanted to ask you, you mentioned there about the Indigenous people of Australia, that they don't not perhaps get enough recognition in history. As what was her relationship like with the locals?
It was interesting and complex. So at the beginning of the colony, when there was only a couple of thousand white people in Sydney Cove, the relationship with the local Aboriginal people of the Eora Nation was largely quite cordial. It wasn't perfect. There were killings and violence on both sides, but there was an attempt at friendship made, and certainly at Elizabeth Farm, Indigenous people were always welcome at the farm. They had a boy who lived with them for a little while, a little boy who was ostensibly the son of a famous warrior called Pemulwuy, who was very anti-colonial, but his son happily lived with the MacArthurs and was a friend of the family for the rest of his life. Same down at Camden, but as more and more money became involved and as the land grab sort of spread out from beyond Sydney, people's attitudes generally hardened towards the Indigenous people, mainly because they're dealing with people they didn't know now as they went out into the wider territory. And Elizabeth's attitude hardened as well. She had some stockmen who were killed by Indigenous people. There were people killed in return, and her attitude hardened and sort of reflected the attitudes of the colony. So that story in itself is quite complex and interesting as well, and sort of reflects the colony more widely.
The Pemulwuy story is an incredible story in itself, and there is that connection there with the MacArthurs and also with Governor MacArthur. And I believe it was Governor MacArthur's gamekeeper that ended up getting in trouble with Pemulwuy. No, it's a different story. We won't go into that one. Will, I've got a question here from David who wants to know, did John fight in the American colonies?
No, he did not. He was only 16 when the War of Independence against the War of England and America ended. So he signed up almost in time to get there, but kind of just missed out. But in an indication of how not ambitious he was for his army career, he didn't actually join up with a regiment that would go overseas anyway. He was with an internal militia full of old men and hopeless cases, really. So the army was never really a strong ambition for him, and he didn't serve in the Americas. He was too young.
Yes, it sounds like it. I'm not sure he had the right temperament for it anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Look, I've also got here, Tony says, behind every great man is an even greater woman.
And look, I think he's certainly not wrong. The MacArthur Empire, and that's what it became in the end, they had tens of thousands of acres across New South Wales, was very much a family enterprise and very much driven by Elizabeth MacArthur. Even later when her sons took over the business, they relied on her. They were never patronising to her. They relied on her for advice and support, and she continued to be very quietly a player in the family business.
If we could get an idea to transpose that time into this time, in today's terms, just exactly how wealthy were the MacArthurs, do you think?
Gazillionaires. Yeah. They did really, really well. They were one of the key people of the colony. They had the biggest land holdings, privately held land holdings in the colony at one stage. The only firm that had more was what was then called the Australian Agricultural Company, which still exists to this day and has land holdings throughout Australia. John MacArthur was involved in the establishment of that company. So that company had bigger land holdings than them, but on a private scale, they were just enormous. And so their farms were like small villages in themselves. They the sons travelled around Europe and brought whole families over to work on their farms, because the convict labour started to run out and wasn't highly skilled anyway. So they went to Germany and to England and brought back shepherds and vintners and skilled artisans to work on their farms. They had little shops on their farms, schools on their farms. It was its own private little world for quite a long time.
I've got a couple of texts here I'll share with you. One that says, thank you for and your guest for relaying an intelligent conversation about Australia's history, especially to do with women and Aboriginal history. We need to know the true history, says Jen in Bondi. Couldn't agree more with you, Jen. You'd probably be the same, I reckon, Michelle.
Yes, isn't that a nice thing to say?
Yep. I've also got here, great segment, but history is about his story, not her story, unfortunately, says John.
That is very often the case, but it is gradually changing, which is good.
Phil wants to know, is there any quotes or images? So there was a couple of portraits painted, wasn't there?
There's some portraits painted. The provenance of some of them is a little bit dubious. So there's a famous portrait of Elizabeth MacArthur that's not in my book that was painted in England when she, as I said, she never went back to England. So whether it's actually of her or not, it's not clear. But if you Google both those names, you'll get some standard portraits coming up so you can have a sense of what they look like. It's probably more, they're probably more accurate portraits of John than there are of Elizabeth. And certainly there are portraits of the family members as well of her sons and her daughters, except for her youngest daughter, of which I could never find a portrait. The youngest daughter married a man who ended up becoming the Premier of New South Wales, and yet I could still never find a portrait of her. And that, again, just talks to the value, the different values that are placed on the head of the male part of the household and the female part of the household.
Reckon there would have been a few portraits of the Premier in question there. Let's have a chat to Thor. G'day, Thor.
G'day. Hi.
G'day. What did you want to say?
Just interesting that out at Gilead, which is in the MacArthur-Onslow property, you know, there's many descendants that you're just talking about before. Yeah. And it's just it's that whole part of that sort of subdivision process that's now moving through, unfortunately. And that Gilead, which is still this sort of really old historical colonial sort of landscape. And I think it was the first area, and I'm not sure if it was MacArthur's that put it in, with actually trying maize and so on through that area, and certainly now it's a cattle property. And it's also, I guess, that sort of really interesting link across the landscape now between that Georges and the Pean River and where koalas are coming back to into that sort of landscape. But it's that sort of whole area, I guess, which has still got that MacArthur-Onslow sort of connection.
Pretty interesting. And you're saying these farms are being sold off now?
Yes, certainly Gilead. I think it's been called One Tree Hill, and it's being sold off. Half of it's being sold off to Lendlease, and the other stage two of that sort of property looks like it's going to be sold off. So pretty soon that whole sort of colonial landscape will become more grey roofs.
Yeah. Thor, thanks you for your call. Pretty interesting way to wind up the conversation here this morning, Michelle. Thanks, Thor.
Cheers.
It is very interesting to see what has happened to the vast wealth that they accumulated and how it's, you know, basically been broken down over the centuries. Are you aware of any of the old properties, old tracts of farmland like that are being sold off?
Look, it is getting sold off because it's right on the edges of Sydney now, whereas before, when they settled it, it was far more remote, and so it's almost inevitable, really, that they'd get overtaken by that. But, you know, good people are fighting the good fight to try and keep some of the original buildings. Certainly down at Camden, the original family home is still there, but some of the original farm buildings are also there, and they're owned by the government now, and they're on government lands called Belgeny Farm.
Okay.
And they're some of the oldest agricultural buildings in Australia, and they've been protected. So there are some wins and along with some of the losses.
So I just want to ask you this quickly, because you mentioned there was a bit of trouble with the Rum Rebellion and Bligh before. I got a text here from Richard Bligh, I'm guessing his descendant, to say that MacArthur should have been hung. He was a self-serving, corrupt crook. And Bligh's could have come out of it pretty well as far as history goes and wasn't necessarily that bad a governor in hindsight that we can say now. Did MacArthur really cop his due? Do you think he was punished enough? Now, we've only got 30 seconds for you to answer that one, Michelle.
No, he probably should have been hung for what was, in fact, a treasonous act. He did overthrow a government. It's entirely possible he should have been tried for treason, and for legal reasons he wasn't. He certainly wasn't in the right when it came to the overthrow of Bligh.
Great talking to you. I've enjoyed it very much this morning, Michelle. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Michelle Scott-Tucker there. She's the author of a book all about Elizabeth MacArthur. It's called Elizabeth MacArthur, A Life on the Edge of the World. And a great discussion there on ABC Radio. Of course, that means it's time for the next news.